Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be hearing about what the great minds of Western civilization had to say about the scourge of economic inequality. But first, a bad, crude, and ugly joke that was told at the expense of Puerto Rico has ticked off a lot of people. Many of them are connected to the island. But what is going on with the future of Puerto Rico? On Election Day, they will be having a vote on statehood once again. But does that mean that Puerto Rico is on the road to becoming the 51st state? We're joined by Christina de Ponce Kraus, a professor of legal history at Columbia Law School, and she is a leading expert on Puerto Rico's plebiscite on November the 5th. And Christina de Ponce Kraus, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first off, let me ask you about this reaction to this joke. The fact that it was that guy had a lot of remarks. They're not jokes because they were awful. But why did Puerto Ricans? Why are they reacting so viscerally?
Well, I think that there were quite a lot of awful jokes and comments at that rally, as well as other Trump rallies, but this one, I think, was especially ugly. You put it right. It was really insulting, and it also exposed an attitude toward Puerto Ricans that we have seen from Trump and his reaction to Hurricane Maria and his resistance to sending funds to Puerto Rico, and that scene with him throwing paper towels at Puerto Ricans as if that were somehow helpful, and his comments about selling Puerto Rico. He has made his own abhorrent attitudes toward Puerto Ricans clear on a number of occasions. And so this kind of, you know, put an exclamation mark on it, and his efforts to distance himself aren't particularly credible. So I think the ugliness of the joke just really brought out something that we've seen in him that's really offensive and problematic.
Right. So in order to be triggered, you have to also be loaded and primed. All these other things have to happen. And then you are like, you know, you're ready to go off because it's not just this one thing. There's a history of disrespect.
Absolutely. And I've just focused on Trump and his comments. But unfortunately, there's a history of treating Puerto Rico differently and as subordinate. The United States annexed Puerto Rico in 1898, and we've been a U.S. colony ever since. And Congress has the power to change that. Congress has the power to make self-determination possible for Puerto Rico because Congress would have to agree to Puerto Rican statehood, and it would have to agree to Puerto Rican independence. Puerto Rico can't change its colonial status without congressional action, and Congress hasn't acted. And so we have a long history of a subordinate status that Puerto Ricans have made very, very clear for a very long time with all these votes on the island. We really want to see come to an end. So there's that long history, and then there's the immediate offenses on the part of Trump and his campaign.
So is there a sense that if there's a particular political party, that if they're able to gain power, that they would make Puerto Rico statehood a priority, that they would act on that?
Well, historically, the Democratic Party has been more amenable to Puerto Rican statehood because of the, really, I was going to say perception, but also reality for a long time, that Puerto Rico would be overwhelmingly Democratic. That has been historically true. More recently, Puerto Rico has moved more in the purple direction. I believe it's still predominantly Democratic, to judge just from the numbers of Puerto Ricans voting in the Democratic and Republican presidential primaries, because as you may know, residents of Puerto Rico do vote in presidential primaries. We cannot vote in presidential elections. Puerto Rico has no senators or representatives, but they do vote in presidential primaries. And so to judge from those, there's still more Democrats on the island. However, there have been some Republican supporters of statehood as well. And there have been Republican opponents. There have been more Republican opponents, again, because of this idea that Puerto Rico is overwhelmingly Democratic. And so the Democratic Party has tended to be the one that was more sympathetic to it. Currently, the Democratic Party has a plank in its platform supporting self-determination for Puerto Rico, not taking sides with one status or another, statehood or independence, but taking sides with the proposition that Congress needs to take action by offering Puerto Ricans an opportunity to vote in a federally authorized plebiscite where they could choose among their non-colonial options. And the Republicans, who historically had a pro-statehood platform, plank in their platform, no longer have it, unfortunately.
So this vote that will be happening on November the 5th, does that qualify, or would this have to happen again?
It would have to happen again. So Puerto Ricans, who have long wanted decolonization, no one wants to live in a colony. Puerto Ricans have voted six times. This will be the seventh vote on status specifically. So we also have our local election, which looks like a state election. We have a vote for our governor and local positions and our non-voting delegate in Congress. So we have those elections as well. But this time, as on a number of other occasions, we have a vote on status itself. And this is the seventh one. So this vote does borrow the definitions of the status options from a bill that passed in the U.S. House of Representatives in December of 2022, but then never made it to the Senate. That bill did exactly what Congress should do. That bill defined Puerto Rico's non-colonial options and explained what the transition to each one would be, and then would have offered them to Puerto Rican voters if it had been made into law. So those options are, as I've said, statehood and independence. And then there's a third option known as free association, which is not the current status. It's a status under international law where basically Puerto Rico would become a separate sovereign, like an independent country, but would also have a power sharing treaty with the U.S. So those are the three options. And Congress did, as I said, the House passed legislation to offer those in Puerto Rico, but then that legislation didn't make it to the Senate. And so the current vote borrowed those definitions from
could
that
make it
bill.
Easier to go on in the future.
Exactly. It's a way of sending a message to Congress saying, look, you know, you passed it in the House, now follow through. And in the meantime, we're going to do the vote, and this is what you should make possible for
I'm almost out of time here. I want to ask you
really quickly,
there's a new poll out, says the majority, a really strong majority of Americans would support Puerto Rico becoming statehood, or they do support Puerto Rico deciding, you know, what's best for Puerto Rico. How does that make you feel, that most Americans support Puerto Rico?
It is truly heartening. The key, though, is that Americans must also support Congress taking action. So Americans will say, we support statehood, but it's up to Puerto Ricans to decide. And Puerto Ricans do get to choose, but Congress needs to act. Both things need to happen. But it's certainly good news that Americans support Puerto Rican statehood. We've been U.S. citizens for almost 100 years. And it's overdue. Absolutely.
Christina D. Ponce Krause is a professor of legal history at Columbia Law School. She's a leading expert on Puerto Rico's statehood attempts. Thank you so much for coming on the air with us today. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about what the great philosophers had to say about economic inequality. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The wealth gap in America continues to widen. In the first quarter of 2024, the top 10% of earners owned almost two-thirds of the country's total wealth, while the bottom 50% owned only 2.5%, and the bottom half of the bottom half owned negative. That's because they're so indebted that they had no assets. This wealth gap is only getting worse, and we're seeing multi-billionaires now getting directly involved in this presidential election, showing a flex of their power. But this isn't new. The great thinkers of Western civilization have thought about the problems of wealth inequality. Plato, Jesus, Rousseau, Hobbes, Adam Smith, Marx, others. What can we learn from them about today's problems? Maybe find some solutions. We're joined by David Leigh Williams. He's a professor of political science at DePaul University. His new book is The Greatest of All Plagues, How Economic Inequality Shaped Political Thought from Plato to Marx. And David Leigh Williams, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the greatest of all plagues, you make it sound, wealth inequality, you make it sound bad.
Well, that has been the traditional take, in fact, on economic inequality. In fact, this phrase, the greatest of all plagues, is one used by arguably the first political philosopher of the Western tradition, which would be Plato, who argued that economic inequality would lead inevitably to the greatest of all plagues, which he took to be civil war. Indeed, notions of inequality leading to factions and dissensions and potentially conflict between the classes goes all the way back to the beginning of the Western canon.
And so in the Republic, Plato wrote that extreme wealth inequality is detrimental to a well-ordered society. He himself saw a war fought about wealth inequality. So he was warning about, this, proposing a form of communal ownership, trying to curb greed, limit economic disparity. But, in the ancient Greek, did they really have that much economic inequality?
Indeed, they had a lot of it. And Athens wasn't even the worst. Athens, where Plato lived, I should say. If you go back to their earliest sources on Greek history, right? If you trace the respective histories of the cities of Athens and Sparta through the famous Roman historian Plutarch, he says that both cities were founded or refounded essentially after crises of economic inequality, which required major interventions by the famous ancient legislators Lycurgus and Solon, respectively. Solon of Athens forgave all debts and canceled those out, and then Lycurgus in Sparta, in fact, went even further to confiscate all property and redistribute it equally, which he thought was the best way to bring about civic harmony.
So is that a suggestion? Should we do that?
Not necessarily. Although, I mean, nobody's suggesting that all property should be confiscated and redistributed. At least, people who are major, political figures in this country. But certainly the question of forgiveness of debt is a major one, right? Of course, there's been a lot of drama surrounding the forgiveness of student loan debt, for example. But this is, again, a tradition that goes all the way back to Solon in ancient Athens. And all of this was certainly on the mind of Plato when he was writing about inequality in his own time.
Our phone number to call in if you've got a question, a comment about the historic ways that we've looked at economic inequality, tremendous wealth versus extreme poverty. The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you are a philosophy guy, here's an opportunity to call in and sort of use that knowledge. So are we talking about the problem of extreme poverty or extreme wealth?
Well, inequality, especially extreme inequality, seems to involve not just extreme poverty, but also extreme wealth. In fact, the poverty doesn't even have to be extreme so long as the gap between those who are relatively poor and those who are rich is significant enough. One of the mistakes I think that many contemporary scholars, economists, and some philosophers and journalists, one of the mistakes that they've been making, I think, in recent years, and something I address in the book, is that there's maybe too much focus on addressing poverty, which is not problematic in itself. I mean, of course, poverty should be addressed. But treating poverty in isolation from inequality, as if inequality is not a problem itself. And one of the arguments of the book is if we're going to at least take the Western canon seriously, we have to take inequality seriously as well, because while pretty much everybody I talk about in the book is concerned about poverty, alleviating that poverty in isolation will not solve the social ills that come from inequality.
Well, I mean, is the fact that there are right currently in the United States, we have very wealthy people like Elon Musk and the Koch brothers who have used their tremendous wealth, not just to accumulate more wealth, but to, you know, directly interfere in my life by getting involved in the political process and preventing things that the majority of Americans approve of from actually being passed. So is it really about wealth, or is it about abuse of their political power?
Well, if we're to believe the vast majority of this Western tradition I discuss in the book, those two things almost inevitably go hand in hand. It isn't, of course, that there aren't wealthy people who are relatively unobtrusive, but you have enough rich people. They are so empowered by their wealth, they find it difficult to resist getting involved.
Right.
And
for example, I don't care that Elon Musk bought Twitter, but I do. Mm-hmm. I am annoyed that he calls it X, and also that he pretty much made it unusable because it's just this constant stream of disinformation and vulgarity.
That's certainly true, right? And his ability to control the political discourse and influence policy and political figures is certainly consistent with notions of democracy as we understand it and as many people cherish it.
Let's go to a caller, and our number is 833-877-8255. What are your thoughts on the thoughts of the great thinkers about economic inequality? Let's go to Claiborne. And Claiborne, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, three quotes. The first one from Plato: an imbalance between the rich and the poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. Jefferson said, whenever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government. He also said, a democratic society depends on an informed and educated citizenry, which, when you have these kind of economic disparities, as we know, with 16 different independent school districts, that becomes a problem. And with these kind of disparities, much like what happened in the French Revolution, the proletariat gets irritated and you get a disordered society, because people are going to feed themselves and their kids by any means necessary.
All right, Claiborne, and so David Leigh Williams, your reaction to Claiborne's comments?
Yes to all of that, right? I don't talk about Thomas Jefferson specifically in my book, but he certainly expressly addresses inequality and expresses a deep concern about inequality, specifically economic inequality, I should say, and thinks it's a great threat, a potential threat to American democracy. And he was not alone among the American founders. John Adams specifically wrote in detail about the threat of American oligarchs, which he draws from the Republican tradition, some of which I address in my book as well. So, yes, absolutely. The American founders had real concerns about this, and as such are part of this tradition of having real concerns about inequality.
Right. So, I mean, one of the solutions in American tradition to deal with oligarchs and these ultra-rich people is having a robust public education system. And the corollary to that is that the oligarchs tend to attack the robust public education system, and they tend to want to hoard information and education into the more elite schools. And we're seeing that now in Texas with school vouchers and other issues. I mean, is that something that the great thinkers that you write about address?
Yeah, they in fact, a lot of them talk about the necessity of education as part of the way in which we're going to deal with inequality. Interestingly, a lot of their interest in educational reform has to do with moral reform. The concern that we find in people like Plato and Rousseau and Adam Smith and certainly John Stuart Mill is that we can use education to try to unteach some of the dangers of selfishness in society. Mill is especially forthright about this, that especially in commercial societies, people are taught that, you know, selfishness is good, greed is good. And Mill says it's not, it's really not. It's actually an enormous social ill. Education is a big part of trying to fix this. And the main goal is to really involve a moral reform, to teach people that it's not good to be selfish. It's better to help or, in fact, love your neighbor. And that in doing so, we build a much more harmonious and enduring society.
And Mill also pointed out that he thought that wealth inequality harmed individual freedom. It warped the social contract.
It does, right? And Mill certainly is very committed to freedom or liberty, right? He's maybe most famous for writing a book called On Liberty. But he's very concerned about the way that inequality affects our liberty, right? If inequality conspires against people getting educated, it's hard to imagine them being able to achieve their dreams, you know, and to use those freedoms in a meaningful way. They'll be largely trapped in a kind of economic prison that constrains their choices.
Right. And so this is, you know, talking about, you know, utilitarianism, being able to maximize the good of the most people. That seems, you know, public education seems to be a way to do that.
Absolutely, right? Education is one of the very best ways to do this. Although I will add for Mill, there's a wrinkle to this. Mill does prefer that the education be private, although government funded. He is concerned about government having too much influence over anybody. He's so concerned that people develop their own individuality. He prefers that there be private individual schools, which the rich can afford on their own, but for the poor, the government will cover the expenses. But every child is absolutely entitled to an education, which is a necessary part of their realizing their freedom.
All right. I do want to. So Adam Smith, you mentioned him, and most people think of him about The Wealth of Nations, which is kind of like the textbook on how to do capitalism. But he was also concerned about the impact of on the poor. I got to hit the break, and I want to talk about that, but I want to get these callers on the air. Also, we need to talk about Jesus, and I don't mean like, you know, in a spiritual way, but what did he say about the wealth and inequality and about rich people and the eye of the needle, all those things? We're going to take a break here. If you got a question or comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies with me on the line, David Leigh Williams, professor of political science at DePaul University. His new book is The Greatest of All Plagues, How Economic Inequality Shaped Political Thought from Plato to Marx. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. And let's go to Doug on the phones. And Doug, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, David. I really like the concept, the feasibility, who knows, but I've heard it said that even if all the global wealth were to be distributed equally, that it would ultimately all end up concentrated back in the same number and probably the same identical hands. So I just wanted David's take on that.
All right, Doug, thank you for that. So is it futile to say we need to address this issue? It all will just, you know, the way money works, it has its own gravitational pull and will just, you know, coagulate once again.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that that seems to be historically the tendency, right? There was an excellent book written a few years ago by a Stanford historian named Walter Scheidel called The Great Leveler, in which he says, well, you know, inequality is actually the norm. It takes some kind of great disruption in order to kind of shake us out of that. Now, one of those great disruptions, which he discusses in his book, was the Second World War, which required mass mobilization and enormous taxes, right, on the richest citizens. And it did lead to a substantial reduction in inequality in the United States and in many, many Western countries. I think our experience, our extended experience with less inequality in those years from roughly 1945 to 1980 suggests that, you know, we could do it if there's a will to do it. Especially in a democratic society, if the people really want that, they can have it. They can compel their legislators to do it. So it's a question of whether people really want to do it. But I think if they do, it's within their capacity.
Well, technological innovation seems to also be something that shakes up wealth. The people who owned Kodak film, they probably lost out a lot when digital cameras came out. And, we saw that with the dot-com era. Suddenly, you know, mentored all these new billionaires. Is that a consideration?
I always use the Blockbuster video example in class when I'm talking about this. Of course, technology is a factor in the growth of inequality. I think if we're going to draw on the lessons of these historical philosophers, people like John Stuart Mill, for example, Mill says, you know, the rules of making money are fairly firm, right? The rules of economic growth are fairly set. There's certain kinds of ways and rules that regulate that are akin to the rules of the natural world, he says. But he says that's all distinct from the secondary question of political economy, which is how are we going to distribute that money? And he says that really is up to humanity to decide. And there's no fixed or natural rules of how we're going to distribute our resources. That is a free choice that societies need to make. If they don't think about them, sure, that money will tend to gravitate into the hands of the most aggressively greedy few, who are always happy to take up the extra revenue.
Let's go to Christian on the phones. And Christian, you're on the air.
Well, this is just mostly a comment. We're always told you get an honest pay for an honest day, but when you can't make ends meet anymore, who's not being honest anymore? And this is my question to the listeners. When do you stop begging for table scraps and demanding your fair share?
All right, Christian, thank you for that comment. And David Leigh Williams.
Sure, right. I think there are real concerns about inequality right now, especially among those who are especially poor. I want to pick up on this metaphor of the table scraps, because this allows me to talk a little bit about the chapter I have in my book about the New Testament. Because in the Gospel of Luke, right, there's a well-known story about Lazarus and the rich man, or as he's sometimes known in the Catholic tradition as Dives, right? And we have this a very poor man, Lazarus, who's covered in sores, and he has these dogs licking his open wounds, and he's holding out an alms bowl to this man who's heading this table where there's a banquet, and he's surrounded by his rich friends, and his servants are coming in to bring new, you know, delicacies for them to enjoy. And they ignore the poor man Lazarus. And then as Jesus is telling this story in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus says, well, then they both die, and Lazarus is redeemed in the afterlife, and Deves goes, you know, to the bad place and suffers, and he pleads and says, you know, no, really, if I had known, I would have lived differently, but he is refused. And he said, you had your choice, right? You had the laws of the Bible, and you ignored them. So, you know, to kind of bring it back now to your listener who just asked the question, you know, when are people going to demand this? They might demand it, you know, next time they sit down to read the Gospel of Luke. It's all in there.
Well, your book, you talk about the metaphor that Jesus said that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God, Matthew 19:24. So either they had really small camels back then or really big needle eyes. What was going on with that?
Well, I mean, I can tell you what the consensus is amongst contemporary theologians. The consensus right now in interpreting that passage is to say, what Jesus is saying is that it's impossible for rich people to go to heaven. Now, I'm sure there might be rich people listening to this broadcast who want very much to dispute that.
I mean,
right?
Who's to say who's rich and who's not, you know?
Sure.
But,
right.
Jesus doesn't provide any formulas. I watch my Sunday morning television and I see a guy up there preaching and he says, that Jesus really wants me to be rich, and Jesus really, really wants him to be really, really rich.
Yeah, that's just simply not in the Gospels. Now, you can find some stray passages in Proverbs and Psalms that are vaguely friendly to that kind of interpretation, but I really focus my interpretation of the Bible on the Gospels, and the Gospels are very exceptionally clear about this. Everybody has a choice between God or Mammon, and if they choose Mammon, right, they've made their choice, right? They've decided that their pocketbooks are more important to them than their spiritual commitments, and you know, God has taken note, right? And I think the Gospels are extremely clear about this, as well as, I should say, as is the book of James, the book attributed to Jesus' brother.
But so there is old Hebrew law that Jesus talked about, which was being ignored, which was the forgiveness of debts and the redistribution of property. And so in many ways, Jesus was kind of a radical at his time, saying that there should be a direct intervention with the income inequality that was happening at the time when he was around.
Yeah, this is absolutely true, right? And one of the things we have to understand about Jesus and his time is the background of the old Hebrew laws, right? Because those were also in effect in ancient Israel. But there was an extreme inequality in Jesus' time. So under normal circumstances, according to the Hebrew law, once every 7 years, all debts would be forgiven. And then once every 50 years, all property would be redistributed back to an original equitable distribution. These laws are known respectively as the sabbatical and the jubilee laws. And they were suspended for various reasons around the time of Jesus. Yeah,
the rich people didn't like these laws.
They didn't. In fact, they argued it was freezing up capital. They said, you know, we'd love to lend money and help people this way, but you know, we simply have no financial incentive to do so. And in fact, they appealed to the local rabbi and got the rabbi to suspend these laws, which led ultimately to them lending money to the poor, especially tenant farmers, and then you know, small landowning farmers.
But Jesus was saying this is bad and we need to go back to this. And this made him a radical, you know, and the money tables in the temple and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they don't tell us this stuff in Sunday school.
No, they tend not to. Right. And there are various reasons for that. And I certainly don't want to go into what people's contemporary reasons might be for this. But I can talk a little bit about Paul, because Paul tends to downplay some of this as well.
All right.
If you'd like to hear about that.
OK, sure. Well, let's go to this break. I've got a caller on hold. I've been ignoring and I got to get him on the air. Margoli, you'll be coming back when we come on. And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255. A lot more to talk about income inequality and what the great thinkers of Western civilization had to say about that. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, the greatest of all plagues, how economic inequality shaped political thought from Plato to Marx. We're joined by the author, David Lay Williams. And let's go to caller, Margoli. Margoli, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Margoli. Hi, Professor Williams. I just wanted to call and ask the question specifically about when you were talking about education being used as a way to deter selfishness in a democracy. So now we see that there's a huge rise in student debt as well as a drop in college enrollment. I was wondering if you could elaborate more on how these two factors in our modern society could contribute to the manifestation of the selfishness in our democracy.
Magoli, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. And so David Lee Williams.
Yeah, I first want to say hi, Magoli. Magoli is absolutely one of my favorite all-time students. She just graduated from DePaul, and I'm thrilled she's on the phone here. So I'll try not to disappoint her with my answer. Certainly, right? The declining numbers of students enrolled in college is alarming to a lot of us who teach at universities. And there are reasons to be concerned about this, also related to, you know, economic inequality, because we certainly know that college education tends to enhance lifetime income and earnings. The more college becomes a niche kind of experience, I think the more we have to worry about the fact that, those few people who go to college are going to end up with the vast majority of the resources. Obviously, that's a problem of inequality. So,
let me just add to this the DEI attacks that we've had recently by our governing regimes. Able to make other people, a diverse population, access higher education is a way to deal with economic inequality as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly insofar as, more doors are closed in front of people who want to get into college, either through the elimination of programs like affirmative action, similar spirited rhetoric that's used by people to try to drive them from college or from certain kinds of professions. That seems, it certainly could be read as kind of a way of kind of enhancing class divisions rather than, trying to broaden learning and enhance wealth and lifetime earnings and so forth. Magoli also raised the question of student debt. And as I've kind of alluded, right, debt was a serious problem in the ancient world. It was a big problem in ancient Israel. It was a big problem in ancient Athens. And debt has traditionally been used as a way of trying to make things all, you know, more difficult for the poor. And it really enhances enlarges the problems associated with inequality, and problems that didn't exist in the same way 50 years ago, you know, when people used to go to state universities and they cost almost nothing. You know, I went to the University of Texas at Austin as a graduate student. I think my tuition was about $1,000 a year, which will make the younger listeners very angry. But you could go to school without accumulating such massive debt, which certainly made the American dream a lot more feasible.
And so with Thomas Hobbes and his take on economic inequality, and he's talked about the consequences of too much abundance, and that he was saying that, what was he saying with that?
Yeah, Thomas Hobbes is famous for, among other things, for arguing that we ought to put all political authority in the hands of one sovereign Leviathan, ideally a monarch. And that doesn't sound very equal, I acknowledge. But the interesting thing about Hobbes's argument is Hobbes says, even with that kind of political system, if you concentrate too much private wealth in the hands of one or a few people, those people become real thorns in the side of the sovereign, right? They compete for sovereign authority. And when Hobbes is writing about this in 17th century England, he's writing about, among other things, the emerging merchant class, people who, you know, might have been, you know, feudal serfs, you know, a century or two earlier, but have now become, you know, very rich through their businesses, and they started contesting the king's authority.
Right. But it seemed like his main concern is stability.
It absolutely is. Well, his number one law of nature is peace, right? He wants people not to fight. And if you have a very rich and very poor simultaneously in a city, you'll have a lot of people who are discontented and seditious, as he says, right? They're eager to overturn the authority. And you have rich people who are eager to overturn the authority. They ask themselves, why aren't I ruling? Why, I have all the money. Why shouldn't I control the government?
Yeah, that's, we're getting a lot of that these days. Let's go to a caller. We have Bobby, and Bobby, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to circle back to his story about the camel and the eye of the needle. You know, yeah, and in the Gospels and in the New Testament and in teachings of Jesus, it is hard for rich people to go to heaven, mainly because they're intent on keeping their riches and not in sharing. But to be fair on that story, you got to finish it all the way, because he does not end up, and most theologians don't say, he says it's completely impossible for a rich man to go to heaven, because after he tells that story, the disciples say, well, then who can be saved? And he finishes up by saying, well, with God, with man, it's impossible. But with God, all things are possible. So as long as the rich man puts God first and then participates in the economy that God sets up, then it's still possible for rich people to go to heaven. And I just wanted to make sure that as a minister and as a theologian myself, I want to make sure that whenever anybody uses scripture, use the full story in its full context.
All right. Well, thank you, Bobby. Appreciate you calling in on that. And so let's get your reaction on that, David.
Yeah, certainly I am not a theologian, right? I am a political philosopher, reading, this ancient text as a political text, right? So goodness knows I am not in a position to tell anybody who is going to be saved and who is not. I'm certainly familiar, though, with the passage just pointed out. And everything I think that was just said, there's truth in that. Although as I struggled to make sense out of that when I was reading my book, I just kept on running into all these other passages throughout the New Testament, where, you know, for example, in Mary's Song of Praise, the passages, woe to the rich, right? In the book of James, right? The rich are our oppressors, right? And then, of course, in this passage about, God or mammon, where to me, as I put these passages together, the best that I can, it seems that the door is closed fairly tight, at least in those passages.
So Jesus, his base really, they were the poor people, and he was working with them, talking to them, and they were reaching out to him. And when he gives the Beatitudes, he's really, he's concerned. He loves the poor.
Absolutely. Right. Blessed are the poor. And it's certainly a ministry that certainly initially appealed to the poor. And in fact, trying to win rich converts was, I think, probably one of the most difficult elements of the early church, given the many things that Jesus says.
So Marx, you have him in the book, and he knows how to fix it all. He's got a solution. So this is where it becomes a how-to book, right?
Well,
all we got to do is overthrow everything and have a huge party.
Marx does.
Has anyone ever tried that? How'd that work out?
Well, there's a lot to say about this. First, I do want to say that everybody that I address in the book has their own version of solutions. Marx certainly has the most radical of them, and to many eyes, the least appealing, because it is certainly most fundamentally disruptive, right? We're going to overturn the entire economic system, right? And this is something that distinguishes Marx from his predecessors who were writing in the context of a commercial or capitalist economy, right, such as Adam Smith or John Stuart Mill, who were happy to kind of work in many ways within the confines of a capitalist economy to achieve greater equality. But Marx believes that capitalism itself is the great engine of inequality. That itself has to be overturned. And it's certainly a radical solution, which makes it kind of a natural place, a natural last chapter in my book.
Right, and it seems to be, there's a lot there that you have to go through the entire book. You see themes repeated, these ideas built upon each other. And it's great that we're able to talk about this in a way to, I think it's all applicable to where we are now, but also has to be considered in the context of its time. But David Leigh Williams, thank you so much for joining us, professor of political science at DePaul University. His book is The Greatest of All Plagues, How Economic Inequality Shaped Political Thought from Plato to Marx. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Caleb Adair is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.